face. His cheeks were always flushed. You could see his pink scalp and the tracks left by the teeth of his comb. He wore little round glasses with gold rims. To Bobby, his smile looked as real as his mother's laugh had sounded. "Gonna play some baseball this summer, sport?" Don Biderman bent his knees a little and cocked an imaginary bat. Bobby thought he looked like a dope. "Yes, sir, I'm one of the Wolves at Sterling House. I was hoping to make the Lions, but..." "Good, good." Mr. Biderman made a big deal of looking at his watch. The wide gold Twist-O-Flex band was dazzling in the early sunshine, and then patted Bobby's cheek. Bobby had to make a conscious effort not to cringe from his touch. "Say, we gotta get this wagon train rolling. Shake her easy, sport. Thanks for the loan of your mother." He turned away and escorted Liz around the Mercury to the passenger side. He did this with a hand pressed to her back. Bobby liked that even less than watching the guy smooch her cheek. He glanced at the well-padded, business-suited men in the rear seat. Dean was the other guy's name he remembered, just in time to see them elbowing each other. Both were grinning. "Something's wrong here," Bobby thought. And as Mr. Biderman opened the passenger door for his mother, as she murmured her thanks and slid in, gathering her dress a little so it wouldn't wrinkle, he had an urge to tell her not to go. Rhode Island was too far away. Bridgeport would be too far away. She needed to stay home. He said nothing, though, only stood on the curb as Mr. Biderman closed her door and walked back around to the driver's side. He opened that door, paused, and then did his stupid little batter-up pantomime again. This time he added an asinine fanny wiggle. What a nimrod, Bobby thought. "Don't do anything I wouldn't do, sport," he said. "But if you do, name it after me," Cushman called from the back seat. Bobby didn't know exactly what that meant, but it must have been funny because Dean laughed, and Mr. Biderman tipped him one of those just-between-us guys winks. His mother was leaning in his direction. "You be a good boy, Bobby," she said. "I'll be back around 8 on Thursday night, no later than 10. You're sure you're fine with that?" "No, I'm not fine with it at all." "Don't go off with them, Mom. Don't go off with Mr. Biderman and those two grinning dopes sitting behind you. Those two nimrods. Please, don't." "Sure he is," Mr. Biderman said. "He's a sport, ain't you, sport?" "Bobby," she asked, not looking at Mr. Biderman, "are you all set?" "Yeah," he said. "I'm a sport." Mr. Biderman bellowed ferocious laughter. "Kill the pig, cut his throat," Bobby thought, and dropped the Mercury into gear. "Providence or bust," he cried, and the car rolled away from the curb, swerving across to the other side of Broad Street and heading up toward Asher. Bobby stood on the sidewalk, waving as the Merc passed Carol's house and Sully John's. He felt as if he had a bone in his heart. If this was some sort of premonition, a winkle, he never wanted to have another one. A hand fell on his shoulder. He looked around and saw Ted standing there in his bathrobe and slippers smoking a cigarette. His hair, which had yet to make its morning acquaintance with the brush, stood up around his ears in comical sprays of white. "So that was the boss," he said. "Mr. Biedermeier, is it?" "Biderman." "And how do you like him, Bobby?" Speaking with a low, bitter clarity, Bobby said, "I trust him about as far as I could sling a piano." 6. A dirty old man. Ted's casserole. A bad dream. Village of the damned. Down there. An hour or so after seeing his mother off, Bobby went down to Field B behind Sterling House. There were no real games until afternoon. Nothing but three flies, six grounders, or Rolly Bat. But even Rolly Bat was better than nothing. On Field A, to the north, the little kids were futzing away at a game that vaguely resembled baseball. On Field C, to the south, some high school kids were playing what was almost the real thing. Shortly after the town square clock had bonged noon and the boys broke to go in search of the hot dog wagon, Bill Pratt asked, "Who is that weird guy over there?" He was pointing to a bench in the shade, and although Ted was wearing a trench coat, an old fedora hat, and dark glasses, Bobby recognized him at once. He guessed S.J. would have, too, if S.J. hadn't been at Camp Winnie. Bobby almost raised one hand in a wave, then didn't, because Ted was in disguise. Still, he'd come out to watch his downstairs friend play ball. Even though it wasn't a real game, Bobby felt an absurdly large lump rise in his throat. His mom had only come to watch him once in the 2 years he'd been playing, last August when his team had been in the Tri-Town Championships. And even then, she'd left in the fourth inning before Bobby connected for what proved to be the game-winning triple. "Somebody has to work around here, Bobby-O," she would have replied had he dared reproach her for that. "Your father didn't exactly leave us well off, you know." It was true, of course. She had to work. And Ted was retired. Except Ted had to stay clear of the low men in the yellow coats, and that was a full-time job. The fact that they didn't exist wasn't the point. Ted believed they did, but had come out to see him play just the same. "Probably some dirty old man wanting to put a suck job on one of the little kids," Harry Shaw said. Harry was small and tough. A boy going through life with his chin stuck out a mile. Being with Bill and Harry suddenly made Bobby homesick for Sully John, who had left on the Camp Winnie bus Monday morning at the brain-numbing hour of 5 a.m. S.J. didn't have much of a temper, and he was kind. Sometimes Bobby thought that was the best thing about Sully. He was kind. From Field C there came the hefty crack of a bat. An authoritative, full-contact sound which none of the Field B boys could yet produce. It was followed by savage roars of approval that made Bill, Harry, and Bobby look a little nervously in that direction. "St. Gabe's boys," Bill said. "They think they own Field C." "Cruddy catlicks," Harry said. "Catlicks are sissies. I could take any one of them." "How about 15 or 20, Bill asked, and Harry was silent. Up ahead, glittering like a mirror, was the hot dog wagon. Bobby touched the buck in his pocket. Ted had given it to him out of the envelope his mother had left, then had put the envelope itself behind the toaster, telling Bobby to take what he needed when he needed it. Bobby was almost exalted by this level of trust. "Look on the bright side," Bill said. "Maybe those St. Gabe's boys will beat up the dirty old man." When they got to the wagon, Bobby bought only one hot dog instead of the two he had been planning on. His appetite seemed to have shrunk. When they got back to Field B, where the Wolves' coaches had now appeared with the equipment cart, the bench Ted had been sitting on was empty. "Come on, come on," Coach Terrell called, clapping his hands. "Who wants to play some baseball here?" That night, Ted cooked his famous casserole in the Garfield's oven. It meant more hot dogs, but in the summer of 1960, Bobby Garfield could have eaten hot dogs 3 times a day and had another at bedtime. He read stuff to Ted out of the newspaper while Ted put their dinner together. Ted only wanted to hear a couple of paragraphs about the impending Patterson-Johansson rematch, the one everybody was calling the fight of the century, but he wanted to hear every word of the article about tomorrow night's Albini-Haywood tilt at the Garden in New York. Bobby thought this moderately weird, but he was too happy to even comment on it, let alone complain. He couldn't remember ever having spent an evening without his mother. And he missed her, yet he was also relieved to have her gone for a little while. There had been a queer sort of tension running through the apartment for weeks now, maybe even for months. It was like an electrical hum, so constant that you got used to it and didn't realize how much a part of your life it had become until it was gone. That thought brought another of his mother's sayings to mind. "What are you thinking?" Ted asked as Bobby came over to get the plates. "That a change is as good as a rest," Bobby replied. "It's something my mom says. I hope she's having as good a time as I am."
"So do I, Bobby," Ted said.
He bent, opened the oven, checked their dinner.
"So do I."
The casserole was terrific, with canned B&M beans, the only kind Bobby really liked, and exotic, spicy hot dogs not from the supermarket, but from the butcher just off the town square. Bobby assumed Ted had bought these while wearing his disguise. All this came in a horseradish sauce that zinged in your mouth and then made you feel sort of sweaty in the face. Ted had two helpings. Bobby had three, washing them down with glass after glass of grape Kool-Aid. Ted blanked out once during the meal, first saying he could feel them in the backs of his eyeballs, then lapsing either into some foreign language or outright gibberish, but the incident was brief and didn't cut into Bobby's appetite in the slightest. The blankouts were part of Ted, that was all, like his scuffling walk and the nicotine stains between the first two fingers of his right hand. They cleaned up together, Ted stowing the leftover casserole in the fridge and washing the dishes, Bobby drying and putting things away because he knew where everything went.
"Interested in taking a ride to Bridgeport with me tomorrow?" Ted asked as they worked. "We could go to the movies, the early matinee, and then I have to do an errand."
"Gosh, yeah," Bobby said. "What do you want to see?"
"Well, I'm open to suggestions, but I was thinking perhaps Village of the Damned, a British film. It's based on a very fine science fiction novel by John Wyndham. Would that suit?"
At first, Bobby was so excited he couldn't speak. He had seen the ads for Village of the Damned in the newspaper, all those spooky-looking kids with the glowing eyes, but hadn't thought he would ever actually get to see it. It sure wasn't the sort of Saturday matinee movie that would ever play at Harwich on the Square or the Asher Empire. Matinees in those theaters consisted mostly of big bug monster shows, westerns, or Audie Murphy war movies, and although his mother usually took him if she went to an evening show, she didn't like science fiction. Liz liked moody love stories like The Dark at the Top of the Stairs. Also, the theaters in Bridgeport weren't like the antique-y old Harwich, or the somehow business-like Empire with its plain undecorated marquee. The theaters in Bridgeport were like fairy castles. They had huge screens, swag upon swag of velvety curtains covered them between shows, ceilings where tiny lights twinkled in galactic profusion, brilliant electric wall sconces, and two balconies.
"Bobby?"
"You bet," he said at last, thinking he probably wouldn't sleep tonight. "I'd love it, but aren't you afraid of, you know?"
"We'll take a taxi instead of the bus. I can phone for another taxi to take us back home later. We'll be fine. I think they're moving away now. Anyway, I don't sense them so clearly."
Yet Ted glanced away when he said this. And to Bobby, he looked like a man trying to tell himself a story he can't quite believe. If the increasing frequency of his blankouts meant anything, Bobby thought, he had good reason to look that way.
"Stop it. The Lowmen don't exist. They're no more real than Flash Gordon and Dale Arden. The things he asked you to look for are just things. Remember that, Bobby-O, just ordinary things."
With dinner cleared away, the two of them sat down to watch Bronco with Ty Harden. Not among the best of the so-called adult westerns. Cheyenne and Maverick were the best, but not bad either. Halfway through the show, Bobby let out a moderately loud fart. Ted's casserole had begun its work. He snuck a sideways glance to make sure Ted wasn't holding his nose and grimacing.
"Nope, just watching the television, seemingly absorbed."
When a commercial came on, some actress selling refrigerators, Ted asked if Bobby would like a glass of root beer.
Bobby said, okay.
I thought I might help myself to one of the Alka-Seltzers I saw in the bathroom, Bobby. I may have eaten a bit too much.
As he got up, Ted let out a long, sonorous fart that sounded like a trombone.
Bobby put his hands to his mouth and giggled. Ted gave him a rueful smile and left the room.
Bobby's giggling forced out more farts, a little tooting stream of them, and when Ted came back with a fizzy glass of Alka-Seltzer in one hand and a foaming glass of Heyer's root beer in the other, Bobby was laughing so hard the tears streamed down his cheeks and hung off his jawline like raindrops.
"This should help fix us up," Ted said, and when he bent to hand Bobby his root beer, a loud honk came from behind him.
"Goose just flew out of my ass," he added matter-of-factly, and Bobby laughed so hard that he could no longer sit in his chair. He slithered out of it and lay in a boneless heap on the floor.
"Ah, I'll be right back," Ted told him. "There's something else we need."
He left open the door between the apartment and the foyer so Bobby could hear him going up the stairs. By the time Ted got to the third floor, Bobby had managed to crawl into his chair again. He didn't think he'd ever laugh so hard in his life. He drank some of his root beer, then farted again.
"Goose just flew. Flew out."
But he couldn't finish. He flopped back in his chair and howled, shaking his head from side to side. The stairs creaked as Ted came back down. When he re-entered the apartment, he had his fan with the electric cord looped neatly around the base under one arm.
"Your mother was right about this," he said.
When he bent to plug it in, another goose flew out of his ass.
"She usually is," Bobby said, and that struck them both funny.
They sat in the living room with the fan rotating back and forth, stirring the increasingly fragrant air. Bobby thought if he didn't stop laughing soon, his head would pop. When Bronco was over, by then Bobby had lost all track of the story, he helped Ted pull out the couch. The bed, which had been hiding inside it, didn't look all that great. But Liz had made it up with some spare sheets and blankets, and Ted said it would be fine. Bobby brushed his teeth, then looked out from the door of his bedroom at Ted, who was sitting on the end of the sofa bed and watching the news.
"Good night," Bobby said.
Ted looked over to him, and for a moment Bobby thought Ted would get up, cross the room, give him a hug and maybe a kiss. Instead of that, he sketched a funny, awkward little salute.
"Sleep well, Bobby."
"Thanks." Bobby closed his bedroom door, turned off the light, got into bed, and spread his heels to the corners of the mattress. As he looked up into the dark, he remembered the morning Ted had taken hold of his shoulders, then laced his bunchy old hands together behind his neck. Their faces that day had been almost as close as his and Carol's had been on the Ferris wheel just before they kissed.
The day he had argued with his mother.
The day he had known about the money taped in the catalog. Also the day he had won 90 cents from Mr. McQuown.
"Go buy yourself a martini," Mr. McQuown had said.
Had it come from Ted? Had the winkle come from Ted touching him?
"Yeah," Bobby whispered in the dark. "Yeah, I think it probably did.
What if he touches me again that way?" Bobby was still considering this idea when he fell asleep. He dreamed that people were chasing his mother through the jungle. Jack and Piggy, the Litlins, and Don Biderman, Cushman and Dean. His mother was wearing her new dress from Gowns by Lucy, the black one with the thin straps, only it had been torn in places by thorns and branches. Her stockings were in tatters. They looked like strips of dead skin hanging off her legs. Her eyes were deep sweat holes, gleaming with terror. The boys chasing her were naked. Spider-Man and the other two were wearing their business suits. All of them had alternating streaks of red and white paint on their faces. All were brandishing spears and shouting,
"Kill the pig, slit her throat. Kill the pig, drink her blood. Kill the pig, strew her guts."
He woke in the gray light of dawn, shivering, and got up to use the bathroom. By the time he went back to bed, he could no longer remember precisely what he had dreamed. He slept for another 2 hours and woke up to the good smells of bacon and eggs. Bright summer sunshine was slanting in his bedroom window, and Ted was making breakfast. Village of the Damned was the last and greatest movie of Bobby Garfield's childhood. It was the first and greatest movie of what came after childhood. A dark period when he was often bad and always confused. A Bobby Garfield he felt he didn't really know. The cop who arrested him for the first time had blonde hair. And what came to Bobby's mind as the cop led him away from the mom-and-pop store Bobby had broken into, by then he and his mother were living in a suburb north of Boston, were all those blonde kids in Village of the Damned. The cop could have been one of them, all grown up. The movie was playing at the Criterion, the very avatar of those Bridgeport dream palaces Bobby had been thinking about the night before. It was in black and white, but the contrasts were sharp, not all fuzzy like on the zenith back in the apartment, and the images were enormous. So were the sounds, especially the shivery theremin music that played when the Midwich children really started to use their power. Bobby was enthralled by the story, understanding even before the first 5 minutes were over that it was a real story, the way Lord of the Flies had been a real story. The people seemed like real people, which made the make-believe parts scarier. He guessed that Sully John would have been bored with it, except for the ending. SJ liked to see giant scorpions crushing Mexico City or Rodan stomping Tokyo. Beyond that, his interest in what he called creature features was limited. But Sully wasn't here, and for the first time since he left, Bobby was glad. They were in time for the 1 o'clock matinee, and the theater was almost deserted. Ted, wearing his fedora and with his dark glasses folded into the breast pocket of his shirt, bought a big bag of popcorn, a box of dots, a Coke for Bobby, and a root beer, of course, for himself. Every now and then, he would pass Bobby the popcorn or the candy, and Bobby would take some, but he was hardly aware that he was eating, let alone of what he was eating. The movie began with everyone in the British village of Midwich falling asleep. A man who was driving a tractor at the time of the event was killed. So was a woman who fell face first onto a lighted stove burner. The military was notified, and they sent a reconnaissance plane to take a look. The pilot fell asleep as soon as he was over Midwich airspace. The plane crashed. A soldier with a rope around his middle walked 10 or 12 paces into the village, then swooned into a deep sleep when he was dragged back. He awakened as soon as he was hauled over the sleep line that had been painted across the highway. Everyone in Midwich woke up eventually, and everything seemed to be all right, until a few weeks later, the women in town discovered they were pregnant. Old women, young women, even girls Carol Gerber's age, all pregnant, and the children they gave birth to were those spooky kids from the poster, the ones with the blonde hair and the glowing eyes. Although the movie never said, Bobby figured the children of the damned must have been caused by some sort of outer space phenomenon, like the pod people in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. In any case, they grew up faster than normal kids. They were super smart. They could make people do what they wanted, and they were ruthless. When one father tried to discipline his particular child of the damned, all the kids
clubbed together and directed their thoughts at the offending grown-up, their eyes glowing, that theremin music so pulsing and strange that Bobby's arms broke out in goosebumps as he drank his Coke, until the guy put a shotgun to his head and killed himself. That part wasn't shown, and Bobby was glad. The hero was George Sanders. His wife gave birth to one of the blonde children. S.J. would have scoffed at George, called him a queer bastard or a golden oldie, but Bobby found him a welcome change from heroes like Randolph Scott, Richard Carlson, and the inevitable Audie Murphy. George was really sort of ripshit in a weird English way. In the words of Denny Rivers, old George knew how to lay chili. He wore special cool ties and combed his hair back tight to his skull. He didn't look as though he could beat up a bunch of saloon baddies or anything, but he was the only guy from Midwich the Children of the Dam would have anything to do with. In fact, they drafted him to be their teacher. Bobby couldn't imagine Randolph Scott or Audie Murphy teaching a bunch of super smart kids from outer space anything. In the end, George Sanders was also the one who got rid of them. He had discovered he could keep the children from reading his mind, for a little while anyway, if he imagined a brick wall in his head with all his most secret thoughts behind it. And after everyone had decided the children must go, you could teach them math, but not why it was bad to punish someone by making him drive over a cliff. Sanders put a time bomb into his briefcase and took it into the schoolroom. That was the only place where the children, Bobby understood in some vague way that they were only supernatural versions of Jack Merridew and his hunters in Lord of the Flies, were all together. They sensed that Sanders was hiding something from them. In the movie's final excruciating sequence, you could see bricks flying out of the wall Sanders had constructed in his head, flying faster and faster as the children of the dam pried into him, trying to find out what he was concealing. At last, they uncovered the image of the bomb in the briefcase, 8 or 9 sticks of dynamite wired up to an alarm clock. You saw their creepy golden eyes widen with understanding, but they didn't have time to do anything. The bomb exploded. Bobby was shocked that the hero died. Randolph Scott never died in the Saturday matinee movies at the Empire. Neither did Audie Murphy or Richard Carlson. But he understood that George Sanders had given his life for the greater good of all. He thought he understood something else as well. Ted's blankouts. While Ted and Bobby had been visiting Midwich, the day in southern Connecticut had turned hot and glaring. Bobby didn't like the world much after a really good movie. In any case, for a little while, it felt like an unfair joke full of people with dull eyes, small plans, and facial blemishes. He sometimes thought if the world had a plot, it would be so much better. "Brodigan and Garfield hit the bricks," Ted exclaimed as they stepped from beneath the marquee, a banner reading, "Come in, it's cool inside," hung from the marquee's front. "What'd you think? Did you enjoy it?"
"It was great," Bobby said. "Fantabulous. Thanks for taking me. It was practically the best movie I ever saw. How about when he had the dynamite? Did you think he'd be able to fool them?"
"Well, I'd read the book, remember? Will you read it, do you think?"
"Yes,"
Bobby felt, in fact, a sudden urge to bolt back to Harwich, running the whole distance down the Connecticut Pike and Asher Avenue in the hot sunshine so he could borrow the Midwich Cuckoos with his new adult library card at once.
"Did he write any other science fiction stories?"
"John Wyndham? Oh, yes, quite a few. And will, no doubt, write more. One nice thing about science fiction and mystery writers is that they rarely dither 5 years between books. That is the prerogative of serious writers who drink whiskey and have affairs."
"Are the others as good as the one we just saw?"
"The Day of the Triffids is as good. The Kraken Wakes is even better."
"What's a Kraken?"
They had reached a street corner and were waiting for the light to change.
Ted made a spooky, big-eyed face and bent down toward Bobby with his hands on his knees.
"It's a monster," he said,
doing a pretty good Boris Karloff imitation. They walked on, talking first about the movie, and then about whether or not there really might be life in outer space. And then on to the special cool ties George Sanders had worn in the movie. Ted told him that kind of tie was called an ascot. When Bobby next took notice of their surroundings, they had come to a part of Bridgeport he had never been in before. When he came to the city with his mom, they stuck to downtown, where the big stores were. The stores here were small and crammed together. None sold what the big department stores did, clothes and appliances and shoes and toys. Bobby saw signs for locksmiths, check cashing services, used books. Rod's Guns, read one sign. Whoa Fat Noodle Company, read another. Photo Finishing, read a third. Next to Whoa Fat was a shop selling special souvenirs. There was something weirdly like the Seven Rock Midway about this street, so much so that Bobby almost expected to see the Monty Man standing on a street corner with his makeshift table and his lobster-back playing cards. Bobby tried to peer through the special souvenirs window when they passed, but it was covered by a big bamboo blind. He'd never heard of a store covering their show window during business hours. Who'd want a special souvenir at Bridgeport, do you think?
"Well, I don't think they really sell souvenirs," Ted said. "I guess they sell items of sexual nature, few of them strictly legal." Bobby had questions about that, a billion or so, but felt it best to be quiet. Outside a pawn shop with three golden balls hanging over the door, he paused to look at a dozen straight razors which had been laid out on velvet with their blades partly open. They'd been arranged in a circle, and the result was strange and, to Bobby, beautiful. Looking at them was like looking at something removed from a deadly piece of machinery. The razors' handles were much more exotic than the handle of the one Ted used, too. One looked like ivory, another like ruby etched with thin golden lines, a third like crystal. "If you bought one of those, you'd be shaving in style, wouldn't you?" Bobby asked. He thought Ted would smile, but he didn't. "When people buy razors like that, they don't shave with them, Bobby." "What do you mean?" Ted wouldn't tell him, but he did buy him a sandwich called a gyro in a Greek delicatessen. It came in a folded-over piece of homemade bread and was oozing a dubious white sauce, which to Bobby looked quite a lot like pimple pus. He forced himself to try it, because Ted said they were good. It turned out to be the best sandwich he'd ever eaten, as meaty as a hot dog or a hamburger from the Colony Diner, but with an exotic taste that no hamburger or hot dog had ever had. And it was great to be eating on the sidewalk, strolling along with his friend, looking and being looked at. "What do they call this part of town?" Bobby asked. "Does it have a name?"
"These days, who knows?" Ted said and shrugged. "They used to call it Greek Town. Then the Italians came, the Puerto Ricans, and now the Negroes. There's a novelist named David Goodis, the kind the college teachers never read, a genius of the drugstore paperback displays, who calls it Down There. He says every city has a neighborhood like this one where you can buy sex or marijuana or a parrot that talks dirty, where the men sit talking on stoops like those men across the street, where the women always seem to be yelling for their kids to come in unless they want a whipping, and where the wine always comes in a paper sack." Ted pointed into the gutter, where the neck of a Thunderbird bottle did indeed poke out of a brown bag. "It's just down there. That's what David Goodis says. A place where you don't have any use for your last name, and you can buy almost anything if you have cash in your pocket." Down there, Bobby thought, watching a trio of olive-skinned teenagers in gang jackets watch them as they passed. This is the land of straight razors and special souvenirs. The Criterion in Muncie's department store had never seemed so far away, and Broad Street, that, and all of Harwich could have been in another solar system.
At last, they came to a place called the Corner Pocket Pool and Billiards Automatic Games Rheingold on Tap. There was also one of those banners reading, "Come in, it's cool inside." As Bobby and Ted passed beneath it, a young man in a strappy T-shirt and a chocolate-colored stingy brim like the kind Frank Sinatra wore came out the door. He had a long, thin case in one hand. "That's his pool cue," Bobby thought with fright and amazement. "He's got his pool cue in that case like it was a guitar or something."
"Who a hip cat, daddy-o?"
he asked Bobby, then grinned. Bobby grinned back. The kid with the pool cue case made a gun with his finger and pointed it at Bobby. Bobby made a gun with his own finger and pointed it back. The kid nodded as if to say, "Yeah, okay, you hip. We're both hip," and crossed the street, snapping the fingers of his free hand and bopping to the music in his head. Ted looked up the street in one direction, then down in the other. Ahead of them, three Negro children were capering in the spray of a partly opened hydrant. Back the way they'd come, two young men, one white, the other maybe Puerto Rican, were taking the hubcaps off an old Ford, working with the rapid seriousness of doctors performing an operation. Ted looked at them, sighed, then looked at Bobby. "The pocket's no place for a kid, even in the middle of the day. But I'm not going to leave you out on the street. Come on." He took Bobby by the hand and led him inside. Seven. In the pocket, the shirt right off his back, outside the William Penn, the French sex kitten. What struck Bobby first was the smell of beer. It was impacted, as if folks had been drinking in here since the days when the pyramids were still in the planning stages. Next was the sound of a TV, not turned bandstand, but to one of the late afternoon soap operas, "Oh, John, Oh, Marcia" shows, was what his mother called them, and the click of pool balls. Only after these things had registered did his eyes chip in their own input, because they'd needed to adjust. The place was very dim. And it was long, Bobby saw. To their right was an archway, and beyond it a room that appeared almost endless. Most of the pool tables were covered, but a few stood in brilliant islands of light where men strolled languidly about, pausing every now and then to bend and shoot. Other men, hardly visible, sat in high seats along the wall watching. One was getting his shoes shined. He looked about 1,000. Straight ahead was a big room filled with Gottlieb pinball machines, a billion red and orange lights, stuttered stomachache colors off a large sign which read, "If you tilt the same machine twice, you will be asked to leave." A young man wearing another stingy brim hat, apparently the approved headgear for the bad motor scooters residing down there, was bent over Frontier Patrol, working the flippers frantically. A cigarette hung off his lower lip, the smoke rising past his face and the whorls of his combed-back hair. He was wearing a jacket tied around his waist and turned inside out. To the left of the lobby was a bar. It was from here that the sound of the TV and the smell of beer was coming. Three men sat there, each surrounded by empty stools hunched over Pilsner glasses. They didn't look like the happy beer drinkers you saw in the ads. To Bobby, they looked like the loneliest people on earth. He wondered why they didn't at least huddle up and talk a little. Closer by them was a desk. A fat man came rolling through the door behind it, and for a moment Bobby could hear the low sound of a radio playing. The fat man had a cigar in his mouth and was wearing a shirt covered with palm trees. He was snapping his fingers like the cool cat with the pool cue case, and under his breath he was singing like this, "Choo-choo-cha, choo-choo-cha, choo-choo-cha." Bobby recognized the tune, "Tequila" by the Champs. "Who you, buddy?" the fat man asked Ted. "I don't know you, and he can't be in here anyway, can't you read?" He jerked a fat thumb with a dirty nail at another sign, this one posted on the desk, "B-21 or Be Gone." "You don't know me, but I think you know Jimmy Girardi," Ted said politely. "He told me you were the man to see, if you're Len Files, that is." "I'm Len," the man said. All at once he seemed considerably warmer. He held out a hand, so white and pudgy that it looked like the gloves Mickey and Donald and Goofy wore in the cartoons.
You know Jimmy G, huh? Goddamn, Jimmy G. Why, his grandpa's back there getting the shine. He gets his boat shined a lot these days.
Len Files tipped Ted a wink. Ted smiled and shook the guy's hand.
That's your kid?
Len Files asked, bending over his desk to get a closer look at Bobby. Bobby could smell sensen mints and cigars on his breath, sweat on his body. The collar of his shirt was speckled with dandruff. He's a friend, Ted said, and Bobby thought he might actually explode with happiness.
I didn't want to leave him on the street.
Yeah, unless you're willing to have to pay to get him back, Len Files agreed. You remind me of somebody, kid. Now, why is that? Bobby shook his head, a little frightened to think he looked like anybody Len Files might know. The fat man barely paid attention to Bobby's headshake. He had straightened and was looking at Ted again.
I can't be having kids in here, mister.
Ted brought again. He offered his hand. Len Files shook it.
You know how it is, Ted. People in a business like mine, the cops keep tabs.
Of course, but he'll stand right here, won't you, Bobby?
Sure,
Bobby said. And our business won't take long, but it's a good little bit of business, Mr. Files.
Len.
Len. Of course, Bobby thought, just Len, because in here was down there. As I say, Len, this is a good piece of business I want to do. I think you'll agree.
If you know Jimmy G, you know I don't do the nickels and dimes, Len said. I leave the nickels and dimes to the niggers. What are we talking here? Patterson Johansson?
Albini Haywood at the garden tomorrow night? Len's eyes widened. Then his fat and unshaven cheeks spread in a smile.
Man, oh man, oh Manischewitz, we need to explore this.
We certainly do. Len Files came out from around the desk, took Ted by the arm, and started to lead him toward the pool room. Then he stopped and swung back.
Is it Bobby? When you're home and got your feet up, pal?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir, Bobby Garfield, he would have said, anywhere else, but this was down there. And he thought just plain Bobby would suffice.
Well, Bobby, I know those pinball machines probably look good to you, and you probably got a quarter or two in your pocket, but do what Adam didn't and resist the temptation. Can you do that?
Yes, sir.
I won't be long, Ted told him, and then allowed Len Files to lead him through the arch and into the pool room. They walked past the men in the high chairs, and Ted stopped to speak to the one getting his shoes shined. Next, to Jimmy G's grandfather, Ted Brodigan looked young. The old man peered up, and Ted said something. The two men laughed into each other's faces. Jimmy G's grandfather had a good, strong laugh for an old fellow. Ted reached out both hands and patted his sallow cheeks with gentle affection. That made Jimmy G's grandfather laugh again. Then Ted let Len draw him into a curtained alcove past the other men in the other chairs. Bobby stood by the desk as if rooted, but Len hadn't said anything about not looking around, and so he did, in all directions. The walls were covered with beer signs and calendars that showed girls with most of their clothes off. One was climbing over a fence in the country. Another was getting out of a packer with most of her skirt in her lap and her garters showing. Behind the desk were more signs, most expressing some negative concept. If you don't like our town, look for a timetable. Don't send a boy to do a man's job. There's no such thing as a free lunch. No checks accepted. No credit. Crying towels are not provided by the management. And a big red button marked police call. Suspended from the ceiling on a loop of dusty wire were cellophane packages, some marked Ginseng Oriental Love Root and others Spanish Delight. Bobby wondered if they were vitamins of some kind. Why would they sell vitamins in a place like this? The young guy in the room full of automatic games whapped the side of Frontier Patrol, stepped back, gave the machine the finger. Then he strolled into the lobby area, adjusting his hat. Bobby made his finger into a gun and pointed it at him. The young man looked surprised, then grinned and pointed back as he headed for the door. He loosened the tied arms of his jacket as he went. "Can't wear no club jacket in here," he said, noting Bobby's wide-eyed curiosity. "Can't even show your fucking colors, rules of the house." "Oh?" The young guy smiled and raised his hand. Traced in blue ink on the back was a devil's pitchfork. "But I got the sign, little brother. See it?" "Heck yeah. A tattoo." Bobby was faint with envy. The kid saw it. His smile widened into a grin full of white teeth. "Fucking Diablos, mano. Best club, fucking Diablos. Rule the streets. All others are pussy." "The streets down here."
"Fucking right down here. Where else is there? Rock on, baby brother. I like you. You got a good look on you. Fucking crew cut sucks, though."
The door opened. There was a gasp of hot air and street life noise, and the guy was gone. A little wicker basket on the desk caught Bobby's eye. He tilted it so he could see in. It was full of key rings with plastic fobs, red and blue and green. Bobby picked one out so he could read the gold printing. "The Corner, Pocket, Billiards, Pool, Auto Games, Kenmore, 8-2127. "Go on, kid. Take it." Bobby was so startled he almost knocked the basket of keyrings to the floor. The woman had come through the same door as Len Files, and she was even bigger, almost as big as the circus fat lady. But she was as light on her feet as a ballerina. Bobby looked up, and she was just there, looming over him. She was Len's sister, had to be. "I'm sorry," Bobby muttered, returning the keyring he'd picked up and pushing the basket back from the edge of the desk with little pats of his fingers. He might have succeeded in pushing it right over the far side if the fat woman hadn't stopped it with one hand. She was smiling, didn't look a bit mad, which to Bobby was a tremendous relief. "Really? I'm not being sarcastic. You should take one." She held out one of the key rings. It had a green fob. "They're just cheap little things, but they're free. We give them away for the advertising. Like matches, you know. Although, I wouldn't give a pack of matches to a kid. Don't smoke, do you?"
"No, ma'am."
"That's making a good start. Stay away from the booze, too. Here, take. Don't turn down for free in this world, kid. There isn't much of it going around." Bobby took the key ring with the green fob. "Thank you, ma'am. It's neat." He put the keyring in his pocket, knowing he would have to get rid of it. If his mother found such an item, she wouldn't be happy. She'd have 20 questions, as Sully would say, maybe even 30. "What's your name?"
"Bobby."
He waited to see if she would ask for his last name, and was secretly delighted when she didn't.
"I'm Alana."
She held out a hand crusted with rings. They twinkled like the pinball lights. "You here with your dad?" "With my friend," Bobby said. "I think he's making a bet on the Haywood-Albini prize fight." Alana looked alarmed and amused at the same time. She leaned forward with one finger to her red lips. She made a shh sound at Bobby and blew out a strong, liquory smell with it. "Don't say bet in here," she cautioned him. "This is a billiard parlor. Always remember that and you'll always be fine."
"Okay."
"You're a handsome little devil, Bobby. And you look..." She paused. "Do I know your father, maybe? Is that possible?" Bobby shook his head, but doubtfully. He had reminded Len of someone, too. "My dad's dead. He died a long time ago." He always added this, so people wouldn't get all gushy. "What was his name?" But before he could say, Alana Files said it herself. It came out of her painted mouth like a magic word. "Was it Randy? Randy Garrett? Randy Greer? Something like that?" For a moment, Bobby was so flabbergasted he couldn't speak. It felt as if all the breath had been sucked out of his lungs. "Randall Garfield. But how..." She laughed, delighted. Her bosom heaved. "Well, mostly your hair, but also the freckles and this here ski jump." She bent forward, and Bobby could see the tops of smooth white breasts that looked as big as water barrels. She skidded one finger lightly down his nose. "He came in here to play pool?"
"Nah.
Said he wasn't much of a stick. He'd drink a beer. Also, sometimes..." She made a quick gesture, then, dealing from an invisible deck, it made Bobby think of McQuown.
Yeah, Bobby said. He never met an inside straight he didn't like. That's what I heard. Well, I don't know about that, but he was a nice guy. He could come in here on a Monday night when the place is always like a grave, and in half an hour or so he'd have everybody laughing. He'd play that song by Joe Stafford, I can't remember the name, and make Lenny turn up the jukebox. Real sweetie, kid. That's mostly why I remember him. A sweetie with red hair is a rare commodity. He wouldn't buy a drunk a drink. He had a thing about that, but otherwise he'd give you the shirt right off his back. All you had to do was ask. But he lost a lot of money, I guess, Bobby said. He couldn't believe he was having this conversation that he had met someone who had known his father. Yet he supposed a lot of finding out happened like this, completely by accident. You were just going along, minding your own business, and all at once the past sideswiped you. Randy? She looked surprised. No, he'd come in for a drink maybe 3 times a week. You know, if he happened to be in the neighborhood, he was in real estate or insurance or selling some one of those real estate, Bobby said. It was real estate. And there was an office down here he'd visit for the industrial properties, I guess, if it was real estate. You sure it wasn't medical supplies? No, real estate. It's funny how your memory works, she said. Some things stay clear, but mostly time goes by and green turns blue. All of the suit and tie businesses are gone down here now, anyway. She shook her head sadly. Bobby wasn't interested in how the neighborhood had gone to blazes, but when he did play, he lost. He was always trying to fill inside straights and stuff. Did your mother tell you that? Bobby was silent. Alana shrugged. Interesting things happened all up and down her front when she did. Well, that's between you and her. And hey, maybe your dad threw his dough around in other places. All I know is that in here he'd just sit in once or twice a month with guys he knew, play until maybe midnight, then go home. If he left a big winner or a big loser, I probably remember. I don't, so he probably broke even most nights he played. Which, by the way, makes him a pretty good poker player. Better than most back there. She rolled her eyes in the direction Ted and her brother had gone. Bobby looked at her with growing confusion. Your father didn't exactly leave us well off, his mother liked to say. There was the lapsed life insurance policy, the stack of unpaid bills. Little did I know, his mother had said just this spring, and Bobby was beginning to think that fit him as well. Little did I know.
He was such a good-looking guy, your dad. Alana said.
Bob Hope knows and all. I guess you got that to look forward to. You favor him. You got a girlfriend? Yes, ma'am.
Were the unpaid bills a fiction? Was that possible? Had the life insurance policy actually been cashed and socked away? Maybe in a bank account instead of between the pages of the Sears catalog? It was a horrible thought, somehow. Bobby couldn't imagine why his mother would want him to think his dad was a low man with red hair, a bad guy, if he really wasn't. But there was something about the idea that felt true. She could get mad. That was the thing about his mother. She could get so mad. And then she might say anything. It was possible that his father, who his mother had never once in Bobby's memory called Randy, had given too many people too many shirts right off his back and consequently made Liz Garfield mad. Liz Garfield didn't give away shirts not off her back or from anywhere else. You had to save your shirts in this world because life wasn't fair.
What's her name?
Liz. He felt dazed the way he'd felt coming out of the dark theater into the bright light.
Like Liz Taylor?
Alana looked pleased. That's a nice name for a girlfriend. Bobby laughed, a little embarrassed. No, my mother's Liz. My girlfriend's name is Carol.
She pretty?
A real hotsy-totsy, he said, grinning and wiggling one hand from side to side. He was delighted when Alana roared with laughter. She reached over the desk, the flesh of her upper arm hanging like some fantastic wad of dough, and pinched his cheek. It hurt a little, but he liked it. Cute kid. Can I tell you something?
Sure, what?
Just because a man likes to play little cards, that doesn't make him Attila the Hun. You know that, don't you? Bobby nodded hesitantly, then more firmly. Your ma is your ma. I don't say nothing against anybody's ma because I love my own, but not everybody's ma approves of cards or pool or places like this. It's a point of view, but that's all it is. Get the picture? Yes, Bobby said. He did. He got the picture. He felt very strange, like laughing and crying at the same time. My dad was here, he thought. This seemed, at least for the time being, much more important than any lies his mother might have told about him. My dad was here. He might have stood right where I'm standing now. I'm glad I look like him, he blurted. Alana nodded, smiling. You coming in here like that, just walking in off the street. What are the odds? I don't know, but thanks for telling me about him. Thanks a lot. He'd play that Joe Stafford song all night if you let him, Alana said. Now don't you go wandering off. No, ma'am. No, Alana, Bobby grinned. Alana. She blew him a kiss, as his mother sometimes did, and laughed when Bobby pretended to catch it. Then she went back through the door. Bobby could see what looked like a living room beyond it. There was a big cross on one wall. He reached into his pocket, hooked a finger through the key ring. It was, he thought, a special souvenir of his visit down there, and imagined himself riding down Broad Street on the Schwinn from the Western Auto. He was heading for the park. He was wearing a chocolate-colored stingy brim hat cocked back on his head. His hair was long and combed in a duck's ass. No more crew cut. Later for you, Jack. Tied around his waist was a jacket with his colors on it. Riding the back of his hand was a blue tattoo stamped deep and forever. Outside Field B, Carol would be waiting for him. She'd be watching him ride up. She'd be thinking, oh, you crazy boy, as he swung the Schwinn around in a tight circle, spraying gravel toward but not on her white sneakers. Crazy. Yes, a bad motor scooter and a mean go-getter. Len Files and Ted were coming back now, both of them looking happy. Len, in fact, looked like the cat that ate the canary, as Bobby's mother often said. Ted paused to pass another briefer word with the old guy who nodded and smiled. When Ted and Len got back to the lobby area, Ted started toward the telephone booth just inside the door. Len took his arm and steered him toward the desk instead. As Ted stepped behind it, Len ruffled Bobby's hair. I know who you look like, he said. It come to me while I was in the back room. Your dad was Garfield. Randy Garfield. Bobby looked up at Len, who so resembled his sister, and thought how odd and sort of wonderful it was to be linked that way to your own blood kin. Linked so closely people who didn't even know you could sometimes pick you out of a crowd. Did you like him, Mr. Files? Who, Randy? Sure, he was a hell of a gizmo. But Len Files seemed a little vague. He hadn't noticed Bobby's father in the same way his sister had, Bobby decided. Len probably wouldn't remember about the Joe Stafford song or how Randy Garfield would give you the shirt right off his back. He wouldn't give a drunk a drink, though. He wouldn't do that. Your pal's all right, too, Len went on, more enthusiastic now. I like the high class. And the high class likes me, but I don't get real shooters like him in here often. He turned to Ted, who was hunting nearsightedly through the phone book. Try Circle Taxi Kenmore 6, 7400. Thanks, Ted said. Don't mention it. Len brushed past Ted and went through the door behind the desk. Bobby caught another brief glimpse of the living room and the big cross. When the door shut, Ted looked over at Bobby and said, You bet $500 on a prize fight, and you don't have to use the payphone like the rest of the schmucks. Such a deal, huh? Bobby felt as if all the wind had been sucked out of him. You bet $500 on Hurricane Haywood? Ted shook a Chesterfield out of his pack, put it in his mouth, lit it around a grin.
Good God, no, he said.
On Albini. After he called